Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Allie Irving for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. Our first article, Want to Live to 100? Try Eating Like a Centenarian. Chew on these nutrition tips from the longest living communities in the world. This article is written by Christina Mannion and RDN and published November 28, 2025. We're all searching for ways to live a long, fulfilling, healthy life, which may explain our fascination with centenarians, remarkable individuals who live to age 100 or beyond. But age is just a number for this rarefied population. Many are still active, engaged, and largely free of chronic disease well into their 90s and 100s, says Dan Buettner, a best-selling author and the producer of the Netflix series Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones. Curiosity about centenarians has led experts to identify so-called blue zones around the world, unique regions where these long-lived individuals can be found in unusually high numbers. Some of these areas include Okinawa, Japan, Sardinia, Italy, Nicoya, Costa Rica, Ikaria, Greece, and Loma Linda, California. What makes these regions remarkable is that people there don't pursue longevity. It ensues naturally from their environment, says Buettner. Movement, social connection, life purpose, stress reduction, and restful sleep are all hallmarks of many centenarian lifestyles. But diet also plays a vital role. While each blue zone has a unique culinary landscape, there are some shared principles that you can easily adapt to your own day-to-day life if retiring to Sardinia is not in the cards. Number one, prioritize plants. You'll be hard-pressed to find much meat in the kitchens of Loma Linda centenarians. And this is because the city has one of the highest concentrations of Seventh-day Adventists in the world, many of whom follow a strict vegetarian, alcohol-free lifestyle. These individuals eat about 95% vegetarian, emphasizing legumes, nuts, and whole grains, says Ella Davar, RD, a longevity dietitian and the founder of the gut-brain method. Plenty of fruits and vegetables fill their plates, with a notable absence of processed foods and added sugars. This plant-forward way of eating can be seen across many of the blue zones, although it's especially pronounced in Loma Linda. And it's no wonder, as a slew of research links vegan and vegetarian diets to increased longevity and chronic disease reduction. Number two, eat like a blue zone local. Not sure where to start with plant-forward eating? Try centering meals around these staples, beloved by blue zone cultures. Sweet potatoes. For decades, Okinawans got 60% of their calories from purple sweet potatoes, says Buettner. These complex carbohydrates are not only beautiful, they're packed with nutrients like fiber, potassium, and vitamin C, and phytonutrients like anthocyanins, which have been shown to exhibit antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and neuroprotective properties. If purple sweet potatoes aren't available at your local grocer or farmer's market, regular sweet potatoes offer many of these same nutrients. Beans, corn, and squash. The traditional diet of Nicoyans in Costa Rica is built around what's called the three sisters, beans, corn, and squash. The term refers to the symbiotic relationship among the crops. Corn stalks provide a trellis for the beans, bean plants fix nitrogen to enrich the soil, and sprawling squash plants offer ground cover to suppress weeds and keep soil moist. These plants also offer varied nutrition when eaten together, including all 9 essential amino acids, plenty of fiber, plant compounds, and several vitamins and minerals to serve nearly every body system. Leafy greens. Icarians eat over 150 varieties of wild greens, Buettner says. The combination reduces inflammation and supports heart health. Get your fix without foraging by cooking with a variety of leafy veggies like spinach, kale, Swiss chard, lettuce, collard greens, and cabbage to obtain the longevity-promoting nutrients they offer, including fiber, folate, calcium, iron, and vitamins A, B6, C, and K. Number 3. No surprise, go Mediterranean. Sardinians enjoy a vegetable, bean, and grain-based soup nearly every day, says Buettner. You likely know it as minestrone, and it's rich in fiber, plant protein, and microbiome-friendly nutrients, he says. It's just one example of the Mediterranean diet they embrace. Rich in whole grains like farro and barley, beans, and seasonal produce. And there's decades of evidence showing the longevity benefits of this widely popular way of eating, not to mention the well-documented perks for cardiovascular, brain, and metabolic health. Number 4. Eat till you're almost full. The centenarian community in Okinawa observes something called hara hachibu, slower, mindful eating that stops before fullness, explains Davar. The practice naturally prevents overconsumption, helping Okinawans maintain a healthy weight and likely keeping a plethora of chronic illnesses at bay, too. Number 5. Embrace herbal teas. They sound sleepy, but they pack a healthy punch. The Icarians drink plenty of herbal teas like sage, rosemary, and mint, beverages that have been utilized for thousands of years as functional foods. Herbal teas can also have mild, anti-hypertensive, blood pressure lowering, and anti-inflammatory effects, Davar says. If you need something with caffeine, you can't go wrong with green tea. Along with a decent dose of energy, each cup provides lots of specific polyphenol called EGCG that is known to fight inflammation. Our second article is called About 1 in 10 Women Experience Migraines for the First Time During Perimenopause. Here's why. Yes, they're debilitating, but hope and treatment are within your reach. This article was written by Lisa Arbetter and was first published November 25, 2025. Sure, we know that menopause is behind night sweats and hot flashes, but is it to blame for everything that goes awry when you're over a certain age? In this series, we're unpacking some of the funkiest health woes people encounter in midlife to see which can be chalked up to the change and which are, well, just a you thing. The first time it happens, you're sure you're dying. A sudden splitting headache with a side of severe nausea that makes light, sound, even thinking unbearable. Convinced it's a stroke, thank you, Dr. ChatGPT, you rush to the ER, endure test after test. The diagnosis? Migraine. But relief quickly gives way to dread. Wait, could this happen again? For an estimated 8 to 13% of women, migraines strike for the first time during perimenopause. I've had patients tell me, this is devastating. I can't function for days, says Heather Hirsch, MD, an internist specializing in menopause care and author of The Perimenopause Survival Guide. And if you already get migraines, perimenopause can make them nastier, longer lasting, and far less predictable. The triple whammy. Experts are still unclear on the exact cause of migraine disorders. Genetics, like having a parent who is prone to migraines, and environmental triggers, like bright, flickering lights or atmospheric pressure changes, are both believed to play a role. In perimenopause, though, three changes collide to make your brain more vulnerable to an attack. First up, the estrogen fluctuations of perimenopause. A sudden drop in estrogen, especially after a stretch of stability or higher levels, can flip the migraine switch in susceptible women. At the same time, your natural progesterone is quietly disappearing, taking with it the ability to calm the brain. And finally, perimenopause's other symptoms, disrupted sleep, stress, even jaw clenching from night sweats, act as triggers. Add it all together and you have a perfect migraine storm. How to calm the storm. Step 1. Rule out red flags. If it's the worst headache of your life or comes with sudden vision loss, weakness, or trouble speaking, go to the ER. Once emergencies like a stroke or an aneurysm are off the table, a two-pronged plan is usually best. Neurology for migraine-specific tools and a menopause clinician to tackle the hormones, says Dr. Hirsch. On the neuro side, fast-acting medications such as triptans and NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like over-the-counter ibuprofen or naproxen, can help stop or shorten migraines. Preventative treatments, including newer migraine-specific drugs like CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide inhibitors, aim to reduce the frequency of attacks. On the hormone side, the goal is to calm the chaos. Some women do better on extended cycle birth control, meaning no placebo week when you get your period, to even out hormonal swings, Dr. Hirsch says. Others may benefit from menopause hormone therapy, HT. One important caveat. Treating a migraine with an aura, a specific type of migraine that comes with a side of temporary visual changes like blind spots and shimmering spots, requires extra caution because these bring a higher risk of stroke. Therefore, any hormonal approach should be managed by someone who understands both headaches and hormones. Lifestyle adjustments can help reduce your exposure to triggers too. Track what seems to set off your attacks in a journal, then see where you can make changes, like prioritizing sleep, eating enough throughout the day to avoid a blood sugar crash, or cutting back on blue light exposure. Supplements like magnesium and riboflavin, vitamin B2, may also help reduce migraine severity and frequency, Dr. Hirsch adds. After menopause, some women, but not all, see their migraines ease with stabilized hormone levels. With luck, you'll be one of them, freeing up headspace for all the other midlife mysteries. The next article is entitled, Six Books That Celebrate Indigenous Resistance, Past, Present, and Future. This article was written by Brittany Penner and published November 13, 2025. She is the author of Children Like Us, and she shares her essential reading list for Native American Heritage Month, including three seminal memoirs, a young adult murder mystery, and a picture book packed with wisdom. November is here, and although I live north of the border, where we celebrate in June, I'm celebrating Native American Heritage Month with you all. As an Indigenous woman, I appreciate the opportunity to reflect upon my relationship with my culture and the journey it's taken me to get here. As I chronicle in my memoir, Children Like Us, I was born to a young Indigenous woman who never held me, never saw the color of my eyes after I left the hospital. I was immediately placed into foster care, and within weeks I was living with my new family. My name had been redacted, my family and cultural history sealed, and I was given a new name, a new culture. Like thousands of others across Canada, I was adopted during a period when Indigenous children were taken from their families through apprehension or relinquishment and placed with non-Indigenous families across the continent. Although the era later came to be known as the 60s Scoop, these specific anti-Indigenous policies lasted until 1991. I was raised in a Mennonite household, alongside 21 foster siblings over the years, and even more adopted and fostered relatives, with the learned belief that being Indigenous meant there was something inherently wrong with us. As a result, the path I've traveled in order to gain a deeper understanding of who I am and where I come from has been anything but straightforward. For generations, as Indigenous people, we've been told that our histories do not matter, our stories do not matter. From practices such as placing Indigenous children in residential schools, to Canada's 60s Scoop, or the American equivalent prior to 1978's Indian Child Welfare Act, to modern-day overrepresentation in the foster care system, efforts have been made to erase who we are. This is why Indigenous stories, like the ones I am highlighting on this list, matter. So many of our Indigenous paths have been touched by pains and traumas, and after generations of being silenced, we can't forget all that our communities have faced. While there is still so much reckoning that needs to happen, there's also so much to celebrate. We are still here. Our grandmothers, our grandfathers, our children, and our communities are still breathing, still singing, still dancing, reclaiming so much of what's been lost or stolen along the way. Indigenous stories are often filled with themes of kinship, resilience, learning from our ancestors, and our connections with each other and the land. These themes are vital and instructive, not just in the fight for Indigenous justice, but for all justice movements. For all readers interested in a more equitable future, the books on this list offer roadmaps for creating change against daunting political odds, capture the influence of historical wrongs on our present world, and illuminate a path for both personal and political healing. Book 1, Who We Are, by Murray Sinclair. The late Honorable Murray Sinclair was a Canadian treasure. As a First Nations lawyer, trailblazing judge, senator, and longtime chair of the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he had an impact on our country's politics and identity that will be felt for generations. Who We Are was his final work, published months before his death in November 2024. It offers Indigenous and non-Indigenous people alike a guide to some of the biggest questions we all ask ourselves in this lifetime. Where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? Who am I? Sinclair lost his mother in infancy, and his father was unable to care for him, so he and his siblings were raised by their grandparents, who were residential school survivors. As a consequence of these schools' efforts to erase Indigenous culture, Sinclair wasn't raised with a strong connection to his heritage. We bear witness to his journey in wrestling with his identity as an Indigenous man, during a time when it was unsafe to identify as Indigenous, and as an Indigenous lawyer and later judge, carving a path no one had yet walked. He shares personal anecdotes with a grounded perspective that comes from a life well examined and a family history fully reckoned with. Most of all, he reminds us all of the value of exploring who and where we come from in order to know where we're going. Book 2, The Knowing, by Tanya Talaga. In this urgent book and its accompanying docuseries adaptation, the acclaimed best-selling Anishinaabe author investigates a family mystery with national implications, the disappearance of her great-great-grandmother. Little about this woman was passed down through the family, and, despite several members searching for years, little information could be found in the official record. It was believed she'd been taken to Toronto, but as to where she ended up, what her life entailed, and how long she lived, no one knew. It ultimately took Talaga and a team of researchers scouring through historical documents to learn what had happened to her. Weaving skillful reporting with rich personal narrative, Talaga connects the broader history of the cultural disconnection that many Indigenous people experience to her own history as an Indigenous woman with European settler heritage who was raised apart from her culture. There's hope that by discovering the story of her lost relative, she may better understand herself and help her family members do the same. What begins as an intimate story of a single ancestor broadens to encompass the disturbing and often overlooked history of government and church-ordained disappearances and genocide in both the United States and Canada. Talaga dives headfirst into painful subjects, but she leaves enough room to pause and reflect before diving even deeper. Storytelling is a foundational component of most Indigenous cultures, and even when we are raised cut off from our culture, many of us still find that we carry this part of ourselves with us. Talaga is a gifted storyteller, which is undoubtedly connected to her identity as an Anishinaabe woman, as she focuses on themes of resiliency and cultural reclamation for both her family and Indigenous peoples across America. Book 3, Heartberries by Therese Marie Mailhot. In this poetic memoir, Mailhot transforms her turbulent coming of age on the Seabird Island Reservation into a fierce act of self-reclamation. Writing her way through trauma, she crafts a luminous, unflinching account of surviving family dysfunction, mental illness, and loss, ultimately finding her voice and a hard-won sense of belonging. She begins writing from her hospital bed while being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar disorder. She chronicles her childhood of abuse and neglect, as well as her story of losing custody of her firstborn, two experiences that are unfortunately common for many Indigenous women, yet often reduced to anonymous statistics rather than recounted as nuanced personal narratives. This book offers a rare chance for readers to either relate to Mailhot or understand on a deeper level what many Indigenous women wrestle with on a daily basis. With many chapters written in the form of letters to her non-Indigenous husband, Mailhot fosters a profound intimacy with the reader and manages to reveal more about herself than any other narrative structure would allow. Book 4, Medicine River, by Mary Annette Pember. While the national conversation about the legacy of residential schools, which forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families and culture for generations, has been ongoing in Canada for many years, it is only just beginning in the United States, where President Biden issued a formal apology in 2024. Ojibwe journalist Mary Pember explores America's reluctance to reckon with its history of violence against Indigenous people, as she details the effects on her childhood and family after her mother was forced to attend one of these schools. Through both historical and personal accounts, Pember highlights the intergenerational trauma that continues to weave itself through communities still processing the impact of these schools and the legacy of government-sponsored cultural genocide. The timing of this book is all the more powerful as certain leaders wish to, again, erase parts of our collective history. In combining her family history with the wider history of these schools, Pember forces us to confront an age-old question that has only grown more timely in this political moment. How might we know where we wish to go when we do not first reckon with the past? Book 5, Fire Keeper's Daughter, by Angeline Bouley. The first in a series of three young adult crime novels, Fire Keeper's Daughter introduces us to Daunice Fontaine, a young woman born to a teenage Caucasian mother and an Ojibwe father who is struggling to find a sense of belonging. Because Daunice's father is not listed on her birth certificate, she is precluded from enrolling in his tribe and has a tenuous relationship to her cultural heritage. But everything changes when she is thrust into an undercover investigation after witnessing a shocking crime. Featuring themes of young love, friendship, and deepening community ties, with a steady sprinkling of traditional cultural practices throughout, this murder mystery / coming-of-age crossover will appear to adult readers of all ages. The storytelling is accessible and satisfying while also leaving readers with a greater understanding of Ojibwe culture. Ultimately, Daunice must ask herself what it means to be an Anishinaabe Kwe, Ojibwe woman, as she learns a simple truth. There's always a way to repair severed connections to our culture when we're willing to learn from those who've come before us. Book 6, Brave Like the Buffalo, by Melissa Allen and Jaden Fisher McNabb. My husband has read this picture book to our newborn daughter more times than he can sleeplessly count. Written by Melissa Allen of settler lineage and illustrated by Cree artist Jaden Fisher McNabb, Brave Like the Buffalo incorporates traditional Indigenous wisdom and symbolism into a universal story about bravery and confronting our fears. Buffaloes are important within many Indigenous cultures across North America. Traditionally, they offer a source of physical sustenance through the harvesting of their meat for nourishment and bones for tools, while also providing necessary warmth through their hides. Spiritually, they are often seen as a gift from the Creator and carry various symbolic meanings in different Indigenous cultures, representing the values of respect, humility, and balance to some, while others honor them for the strength and unity of their herds. This story's buffalo calf is frightened by an oncoming storm, and certain he has no choice but to run away. We do not run from the storms. We run courageously through, the mother calmly counsels her son. Like much of Indigenous history, this children's book teaches us to trust our connections with each other and with the land, and to believe that we will feel the warmth of the sun once again. Our last article for this podcast is, Oprah wants to know what you think of going no contact with family. There are some instances where there needs to be no contact. This article was written by Oprah Winfrey and originally published November 30th, 2025. Every week, Oprah is setting an intention exclusively for Oprah Daily Insiders with reflections on topics like letting go, forgiveness, coming into your own, and more. Hey, everybody. I hope you had a good holiday and that all the relatives came and people got along at the table. I hope that was the case for you at your house. It certainly was at mine. Everybody gets along and everybody's doing well. Recently, I got a call from a friend who shared with me that her child, who was 32 years old, had suddenly gone no contact. She had gone to a movie, had dinner and everything, was really fine with her daughter. Then, all of a sudden, she gets a package in the mail saying, "Do not try to reach me or call me or contact me in any way. I am removing myself from this family." My friend says she was frightened, thinking that something had happened and that perhaps her daughter had been kidnapped. As it turns out, once the police did reach her, the daughter said, "No, I just no longer want any contact with my mother or anyone in the family." I had read an article about this, but I didn't know that it was a common experience with lots and lots of families in the United States. And so, as I'm prone to do, I called in the experts and we're doing a podcast this week about families who have gone no contact. We have people who have gone no contact and people who wish their kids hadn't gone contact. We are representing all sides of the issue. Hopefully you will watch and maybe find a path forward. That's what I'm hoping people will do. Find a path forward for themselves, or at least be open to both sides. For years, I've been saying this. There are some instances where there needs to be no contact. But there seems to be a trend now where anytime somebody is offended, or they feel like their family hasn't emotionally supported them enough, they feel the need to take all contact away. Let me know what you think after watching our podcast on no contact families. And also, let me know what you think about this subject. Go well. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Allie Irving, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
High enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are.